Hey, Megan.
Hey, Matt.
How's it going?
Pretty well. I'm in my offices here at the beautiful Watergate in Washington, D.C.
I am, too. It's great that technology has reached the point where, you know, we're using Skype to talk on the phone over the internet, even though you're, like, a couple yards from me.
Is it yards? I'm not good at these measurements. Yeah, I think it's great the way technology is bringing people together who otherwise wouldn't be able to talk.
Totally. Yeah, and it's ironically, I mean, Bob told me that the Blogging Heads technology is not sophisticated enough to record two people who are actually in the room at the same time.
No.
It's completely dependent on this kind of, you know, telecommunications infrastructure. So these are, I guess, the paradoxes of
modernity.
Modernity, yes. It's deep.
I believe Camus wrote something about this.
Camus didn't have Skype, you know. He might have been more cheerful. Well, speaking of modernity is like zoning.
Modernity is like zoning. Nice segue. That was very
sure,
slick.
Sure, totally. Which, yes, it's brilliant. Which you think people are interested in, zoning.
I mean, I think they're mostly interested in it in the sense that, like, whenever anyone wants to build anything near them, suddenly they become fantastically interested in the subject of zoning and why no one else should ever be allowed to build anything near anyone.
Well, or there's a specific distance people... Well, anyway, to back it up a little bit, I mean, this started... You know, I was looking at global warming plans, which they differ in important ways that, you know, people who cover this can tell you, but the general idea is to, you know, cap carbon emissions and then take some steps designed to sort of make it easier for people to live in the new capped universe. This tends to involve a lot of either using money to subsidize, you know, renewable energies, that kind of thing, or else, in some hypothetical plans, just rebate money from a carbon tax to people flat. Mm-hmm. And I was saying that it at least seems like one of the things you could do that would make it much more affordable for people to live lower carbon lifestyles would be if you, you know, deregulated a lot of the building height restrictions in major urban areas and just made it would be cheaper to live in central cities if it was easier to build large structures in them.
Right. I have these fascinating conversations with my friends, especially my friends who live in Brooklyn, where they're like, you know, it's a tragedy that New York has no affordable housing. Uh-huh. God, of course I don't want anyone to build anything taller than three stories in my neighborhood. I love my neighborhood exactly the way it is. And the irony of these two positions never seems to strike anyone.
Right. But I have to say, I hate my neighborhood the way it is. I wish it had much, much more taller buildings.
Do you really? I'm very fond of you, Street Low. I mean, I recognize my own hypocrisy. I just think that I shouldn't be allowed to exercise my...
No, I mean, you know, I like it, obviously. It's where I choose to live. But I mean, D.C. in general, I wish that there were more tall buildings. I like that I live in a semi-detached row house, but you know, I feel like if there were more tall buildings around, which there are a few, but that if there were more and there were more people living there more densely, that we would have more stores, more variety of places to go,
more sushi.
That would be more sushi. Well, the sushi place, yes.
We now have for those who are not following along at home, Matt and I live three blocks from each other, and our neighborhood just got its first sushi place.
Right.
Which I actually have you eaten there yet?
No, I haven't.
But I'm excited just that it exists.
I'm excited that it exists, and I wish we had, say, an Indian restaurant. And I think we might have an Indian restaurant if, you know, if the new condos that came up were, like, you know, 27 stories tall instead
right.
of seven. And, you know, so I don't really see what people's problem is with tall buildings.
Well, I think the thing about zoning, right, is that everyone wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. Most people who live in urban areas, they move there, they like density. They like it in theory. They like having all of these amenities that you get from density. My mother just moved down here, actually, and, like, she lived in New York for 40 years, and she's still I tried to prepare her, but I just don't think she was emotionally able to grasp that it wasn't going to be like New York just because it's another big city.
No.
And so she didn't grasp things like there really isn't going to be a good butcher anywhere in the district. Eastern Market, maybe. She's sort of experimenting down
right.
there. And all these things that she's a huge foodie and that she's kind of used to on New York and the Upper West Side.
Sure.
Cheap produce, which is just a weird, right? There's no Korean vegetable markets here.
No.
But at the same time, everyone wants to live in their semi-detached row houses, and they want that to be affordable. They want to be able to live in semi-detached row houses. They want some other person to go live in tall condos in order to bring them the amenities that density provides. And I think
right.
that's sort of, right, they don't want the condos near them. They want the condos somewhere else, but just close enough to give them amenities without providing any of the annoying people who live in the condos.
Right. Well, but I mean, it does seem to me that this is, in part, it's an artifact of the level at which zoning decisions are made. Right? That when you set the institutional structure at such a fine-grained area as it is now, it makes it easier for people to adopt that kind of mentality that you're talking about, because since the decision-making units are so small, you know, it's easy to think simultaneously that you would like the metropolitan area as a whole to be radically different, but not see the change in your very, very local area, because there's not a need to make that kind of citywide choice. If the authority were just structured in different kinds of ways, I think you might get different outcomes.
Right. No, and I think that there's you know, it translates into the way that you see poverty policy done in America. I think there's definitely an argument for doing zoning at some larger level than it is currently done, which even in cities is usually at the fairly local level.
Right, at this very granular. We have these things in D.C., these advisory neighborhood commissions, of which there's a bunch. There's several per ward. And then they have subunits, so that you have individual representatives who represent just tiny, tiny areas.
Yeah, it's like, I'm the commissioner from this block, from this tree to that fire hydrant.
Right, well, and I mean, it encourages, I mean, the sort of the NIMBY impulse, you know, is going to exist no matter what you do, but when you design institutions that way, it really just empowers that side of people's thinking about planning.
No, I think that's true, and like you see, I guess I'm sort of repeatedly shocked by my friends. And just people I know and so forth who are committed liberals and who really believe in affordable housing and at some level even recognize that if they artificially constrain the supply of housing, poor people won't be able to live there.
Uh-huh.
But when it comes to their neighborhood, like they're just astonishingly good at coming up with special reasons why this shouldn't happen right where I am.
Right.
You know, it's bad for the community. It's bad. That bank just doesn't belong there. It's not that I'm against banks. I like commerce. Whatever. I just don't want a bank in my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I don't want that store on my corner. But you know, stores are fine, and almost everywhere else, people should be allowed to put up stores on corners because they're into Jane Jacobs in the walkable city.
Uh-huh.
It's just in my on my block. There's some special circumstance that applies only to my block. Which allows me to keep these things out because I don't want the foot traffic around and I want my kids to be able to play in the street and so forth.
Right, right. Okay, well, you know, bigger units, maybe
we
can
hope.
Change things. But so, density, you know, as I guess we were saying, we both grew up in New York City. Rudy Giuliani was the mayor there.
Indeed. What do you think of him as mayor?
Well, I should say, I mean, I as a very young, 13-year-old maybe, in 94, I was already getting a start on my reasonable liberal credentials by really outraging my family, saying that I thought we should give Rudy Giuliani a chance. You know, and I think he did a pretty good job. I mean, it's... you can engage in a sort of endless debate about how much credit he really deserves for the crime drop. Obviously, he doesn't deserve as much credit as he would like to claim
yes.
for it. Since, you know, that's life. But my view, at least, is that unless there's clear evidence that this happened, like, despite him, that, you know, you should give a politician credit for the good things that happen under his watch, especially when it's so clearly, I mean, he campaigned saying he would reduce crime. He took office. He changed some things. Crime did go down a lot. I mean, it went down a lot across the country, but it went down even more in New York City. And, you know, I was prepared to support his reelection on, you know, those terms, if nothing else. In his second term, you know, he got involved in some sort of pointless, you know, business, which I guess we'll talk about later. But, you know, it was a pretty good record. And it's reflected in the fact that when Mark Green, who was the Democratic nominee in 2001, was running, you know, he was really promising that on those key subjects, he was going to continue the Giuliani legacy. Yeah. Nevertheless, I think it would be really terrible if he were president.
Yeah, no, the thing is, I like you, like, my dad hates him. And more broadly, you know, I think his record is mixed. I think he should get credit for some of the crime reduction. I think Comstat was an amazing invention. Not his, it's Bill Bratton. And I think it actually is kind of shameful the way that he sort of, when things work out, shoved the people below him who've been responsible out of the spotlight and then hog all of the glory for himself. But I mean, it's not exactly unique behavior in a politician.
Right.
But I think the consensus of almost everyone I know in New York, even the ones who like him, is that he's crazy and therefore should never, ever, ever be elected. As president, the things that he's good at aren't things that the president particularly needs to be good at. That he has a lot of personal problems, which are sort of okay in the mayor of New York, but don't really have the gravitas you would want. I mean, you don't really want him to, like, dress up in drag at a benefit for the Russians.
Sure,
you know?
But even lovable, right? I mean, it's New Yorkers like a character, right?
Exactly.
And so some of Giuliani's things, like there's this famous incident, you can find the clip online, I'll try to dig it up, of him screaming at someone on the radio about ferrets and about why is this guy... It was Giuliani.
Why are you a ferret lover? Yes.
Right. I mean, Giuliani signed some bill to ban ferrets. Some ferret lover called up, was complaining, and Giuliani was just calling him sick and deranged. And you know, it was funny. It's funny in a mayor, because the mayor of New York, of even a very big city, doesn't really have all that much actual power.
And I think that's actually this is the big problem that I end up having. Right? Is that in a way, what people in New York wanted in 1993 was someone who was a little bit fascist, right? They wanted someone who was going to come in and err on the side of cracking down, err on the side of reading the law as broadly as possible to give the police as many powers as possible. And you can argue about whether that was justified or not, but that's certainly what people wanted. And I think, but the reason that that's even sort of acceptable to talk about is that there's a whole court system that prevents him from going too far.
Right, he was going to be backstopped by the Supreme Court.
Yeah, exactly.
Mario Cuomo was governor. Bill Clinton was in as president.
Exactly. You don't want that same person being in the presidency, trying to go too far, and then being able to appoint justices to the Supreme Court who agree with him.
Or just do things completely in secret.
Yeah, exactly. That's another thing. I mean... that's a question. I actually think in this sense, I'm trying to make an argument that Giuliani would be even worse than Bush, because the stuff he's willing to do in public pushes the envelope so far, and because I think there's no one willing to backstop him on that, and that's frightening to me.
Right, and even, you know, things that were, is distasteful. A certain of the glory hound kind of aspects that Giuliani had, but in some ways, you know, I think forgivable in a local politician.
Yes.
You know, but the president, I mean, the president doesn't need to go out of his way to get attention. And it seems to be so deeply ingrained in his character. I mean, more so than for your average, ambitious, up-and-coming politician. This desire to sort of shove other people out of the way, grab the spotlight. And all those kind of personal characteristics, it just seems... hard to imagine in a president, and especially for someone who, just in virtue of his prominence, is able to go from being a mayor to being a presidential candidate without any kind of, I don't know what, simmering period in the Senate or something.
Yeah, and I actually think, too, that he really is, what you say about seeking attention, it's sort of a characteristic of New York politicians more and more. I mean, I don't know what would happen if say... Chuck Schumer were standing between Rudy Giuliani and a camera that he wanted right, to be sure. at, but I don't know who would die that someone clearly would.
Immovable object and exactly. unstoppable force, right.
But yeah, I think in general the consensus is this is not a man you want with his finger on the nuclear button.
Right, yes. If only the people outside of New York would learn.
Do you think people are really going to... I guess I'm just amazed that the idea that this is who we... These are the people we have. I'm kind of flabbergasted. Not because I have any particular brief against Hillary Clinton as a candidate, but I just find it so extraordinary that people are willing to go sort of Bush-Clinton. And
no, it seems dispiriting. I've been joking that, you know, we're going to have, like, Chelsea Clinton will, you know, be married off to George P. Bush. And, you know, this sort of, like, you know, resolve it. I think the Hundred Years' War may have ended with some kind of compromise like that. And it's unfortunate. I mean, you've had a blog post, I guess, saying that you didn't see people who were the Hillary enthusiasts.
And my dad is. My dad really likes her. I know a couple.
Right.
But I don't know a lot.
Right. I had sort of initially started off thinking that like her campaign was just gonna collapse. It was like a paper tiger that, you know, people would see a little bit more of Obama or something and she would melt. It seems to turn out demographically, though, that just you and I know all the wrong people. You know, that younger, better educated Democrats who pay more attention to politics are, like, who's, you know, most of the people I know, I think a lot of the people you know,
yes.
are like, her worst demographic, but that, you know, everyone, you know, we don't know... High school dropouts and, you know, Midwestern Union members and so forth are, you know, that's where the Hillary fans are.
I mean, I think the advantage that she has is there's this implicit promise, right? Like, elect me and I'll bring back the 90s. But which is sort of like disturbingly shamanic.
Sure.
But maybe we can just send her out to do a rain dance periodically to halt global warming. But there's also this... I think this thing that I felt very strongly with Kerry, which was that John Kerry was what a Democrat thought a Republican wanted to vote for. They were like, he was a nom. Like, you guys love uh-huh, that uh-huh. stuff. And of course, none of the Democrats I knew. I knew one Democrat who liked him and worked on his campaign really early. But other than that, I didn't know any Democrats who liked him. They were all kind of like, eh. And they nominated him because they thought Republicans would vote for him, but the Republicans weren't any more charmed than he was. And
sure.
the sense that I have is there a lot of that no one I know like just goes, except my dad, is like, God, Hillary, I love Hillary, I want to vote for Hillary, she's just fantastic, I can't wait until she's up there and I can cast my ballot for her. The way they were about Bill Clinton, people were obsessed with him, right?
Uh-huh.
And so my sense is that, like, what's going to happen, and I have these conversations, I've had a couple on my blog, and in person, where people are like, oh, yeah, but she's a great campaigner, and we need that. It's like, you don't. You can uh-huh. run, like, Gumby against
yeah,
the Republican.
But
run Gumby. You're better off running Gumby than running someone who has huge negatives.
Right, but I actually think this is different. I mean, I think that the Hillary fans, and they're there, and I think they're not people you know, as much, but like your dad, that they really are Hillary fans, and then it's almost the reverse of John Kerry. That, I mean, people are voting for her fully knowing that Republicans hate her because there's a thirst for revenge, might be one way of putting it. But, you know, just a sense that she knows how to beat these bastards and has been fighting them for a long time, and that, you know, the climate's right to sort of hand them a, you know, just a thumping and put her in the White House, and, you know, then we'll show the Republicans.
I mean, I'm somewhat indifferent because I have various reasons to vote for various Democratic candidates I think my mother is the swing voter. So uh-huh. my mother's vote has correctly called every presidential election
All right.
Since the early 70s.
Fair enough.
So I keep thinking it's going to fail, and each time she pulls it out again. Uh-huh. When she voted for Bush in 2004, I was like, oh, that's it. She's broken the magic. But now, and she hates Hillary. She just personally despises her. Uh-huh. And my mother is the kind of person that you need to pick up. Because you know the Republicans aren't going to vote for her. Maybe they'll stay home.
Sure.
But if you don't pick up my mother, you're screwed, is my personal opinion. And she lives in New York, right? And she's, like, liberal. She gives a lot of money to... She's not liberal. She's a swing voter. She gives a lot of money to... She's very pro-choice. She's very, like, socially liberal and so forth. But, you know, also and sort of fiscally conservative, but supports Medicare. I mean, she's, like, a mushy swing voter.
Sure.
And she just hates Hillary. And I think that visceral reaction that a lot of moderates have, and I know, people we know, one of our friends was telling her mother, who's like a rabid liberal, hates Hillary and is out working against her. Like, women in that demographic seem to really dislike her for reasons that I don't know.
Hating demographic.
Yeah, like, I mean, no one hates Obama, right? No one hates John Edwards. There are a lot of people who just viciously despise her, and that's not a really great thing even before you've gotten the general election off. Because, you know, right now no one's campaigning on her negatives because they're also trying to claim the Clinton administration mantle. They're trying to say a little bit, right, like if you vote for Democrat, the 90s will come back. Well, when the general election happens, those gloves are going to be off. The Republicans are going to be more than happy to bring up every bad thing that happened in the Clinton administration and stick it on Hillary, and some of that will stick. So I think she'll probably win anyway. I mean, I do think that the Democrats could almost run Gumby. But I think that I'm kind of puzzled because I'm not sure I understand the reasons that the Democrats are nominating the candidate who I feel is the strongest chance of losing.
Right. Well, you know, this is, I wrote an article with Sam Rosenfeld saying this like a year ago, but you know, apparently the voters don't really care. What it seems like sufficient, but you know, it's true that you can see that support for Hillary is inversely correlated with the amount of attention that people pay to politics.
That's true. She's got name recognition, right?
Right. Well, no, but I mean, it's not that I think she's going to lose for that reason. It's just that I think people who pay a lot of attention, but not so much attention that they're, like, personally employed by the Clinton political machine, you know, recognize that this is not, like, a sound strategy. But that to people who pay less attention, you know, Bill Clinton won. The Clinton brand is a winning brand. And so, you know, why not? As for the reasons you say, it doesn't really make a
Well, but the other thing that puzzles me is that the Netroots hates her, right? I mean...
Sure. But those are very high information people. Yeah. I mean, those are people who spend all their time, you know, free time reading blogs about politics and stuff. Normal people, you know, don't care. They'd rather watch Gumby.
That's true. And Gumby is a good show.
Yeah, what right. I was wondering what was with the Gumby bashing earlier.
No. I think you could run Gumby. He's got a lot of personality. I mean, I don't know what his policy platform is.
Yeah, sure. Well, he's flexible.
Yeah. Perhaps a little wishy-washy.
Sure, right. No, it's that's great. They got to bring Gumby back. But so, I you know, speaking of television, I'd recently gone and checked out Gossip Girl.
Yes, you've been telling me about this.
Right, yes, new on someone, on the CW, because it was a show that promised to explore the milieu of our upbringing.
The supreme irony, right, is that it replaced Seventh Heaven. My understanding is it replaced a show about growing up as a preacher's kid in some, like, non-denominational suburb in California.
Exactly. And you know, I'd seen for years, you know, a million more movies than TV shows, but sometimes TV shows where people go to generic suburban high and they have whatever, you know, antics one has, and, you know, 10 Things I Hate About You or whatever. And I was glad to see, you know, real childhood in a very expensive New York City day school.
Something more authentic in America.
Exactly. Something salt of the earth, Manhattan types. And it's disappointing. The show, it doesn't seem to have any Jewish characters, and it doesn't even seem to have any Catholic characters. It's like, you're supposed to believe that modern-day rich New York is this, like, wasp paradise out of, I don't know what, like a, like 100 years ago.
Which is really, like, I grew up in, we both went to similar type day schools, except that mine had trees.
Sure.
I remember, actually, like, my school was so heavily Jewish that people used to call me, like, the affirmative action, the token Gentile.
Uh-huh.
And also, like, the wasp bashing was so bad at these places, I would just make sort of casual nasty comments about wasps. And I have, despite my last name, I'm half wasp. My mother's family has been in the country since the inception and of Anglos here. Although
right.
they, like, unfortunately, they didn't go and, like, get Park Avenue apartments. They just went and squatted on the same piece of land in Western New York for 300 years, which turns out to have been a like, it looked good when the Erie Canal was being built, but it was ultimately a bad call.
It's a good canal.
It's a lovely canal, and in fact runs straight through the town, runs right past the gas station that my grandfather owned. And I didn't realize it for years, like the little trickle of water behind my grandfather's gas station was in fact the mighty, mighty Erie Canal. Anyway, so I would, like, come home and deliver these, just some sort of snide, nasty comment about wasps. My mother finally one day just turned around, she's like, what do you think you are?
Mm.
We're Baptists, and we were not, like, the kind of Baptists that you think. We were something called American Baptists. We went to Riverside Cathedral on the Upper West Side,
okay.
Which is like being a Unitarian without the dogmatic theology.
Sure, hardcore.
Exactly. And so, yeah, I am half wasp, but I was like the only one in my school, as far as I know. There was none of these wasps who I'm sure were in fact there in the 50s. They're gone now. They're like an endangered species.
Well, and even the ones who were there, they send their kids to boarding.
They go to boarding school, exactly.
Because wasps, I was always taught to believe, don't love their children. And you know, so they send them away. But they're not going to day school in New York. But I think it says something about America, you know, that this is what people want to see, though, is this kind of like this fake idea of New York or something.
Yeah, and it's to me such a weird fantasy. I think because in a way I always fantasized as in high school about having some like rich ethnic background.
That's weird. But I mean, it just wouldn't like occur to me. It just seems like a strange impulse to
like
do.
Well, my other basic problem, and tell me if this actually happens in the show, because unfortunately I haven't watched it yet. What I hate about all of these shows is that like the rich people in them, I mean, I don't want to say, I actually think I did get some very strange ideas about money having gone to one of these schools, despite the fact that I was one of the poor kids in the class. You know, my parents sort of put everything they had into educating me. And I came away with strange ideas about money and class that I didn't know I had, and it took me a while to get rid of. But I think it's like this weird, blatant and overt snobbery that just doesn't exist. No one ever says, you know, oh, she's poor, that's funny. But they do in the movies all the time, and it's incredibly irritating. You're looking at this like, I mean, maybe it happens in the suburbs.
It's possible. No, but I mean, obviously, it's the essential thing about rich people. I mean, at least rich people with any people from a higher class mentality, at least, don't talk about money.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's the essence of it. Right. Is that the idea is that you are rich enough to not care about what things cost. And to not be talking about this stuff, and would not at all be, sort of like
in an overt way,
talking down to people that way, because it's not a classy way to behave.
And when they do talk about money, right, at least in my experience, when they overtly talk about money, it's never about people who don't have any. What I have seen is people, you know, with older money or older families and no money left, talking about people who just made a lot of money and how they're vulgar. I can't remember who it was. Someone, I remember sitting next to someone who actually, I forget, someone was being rude to a waiter three tables away, and he just turned around and said, you can always tell new money because they're mean to the help.
No, I... Yeah, exactly. All the more so if the idea is supposed to be that these are new money people, and that's why they're such jerks. Then it makes even less sense to have them be part of some
exactly
WASP aristocracy,
cut like Vandenheisenhubel.
Right. Yes. I mean, they all have these preposterous Dutch names, which is a weird bit of local authenticity because it's only in New York where old-timey WASP people would have weird Dutch names.
But they also, all those people that I've ever known, got immediately shipped out of New York as quickly as possible.
They're done. It's yesterday's news. And surely, like, Hollywood producers and owners of television networks and stuff are aware of the fact that there are prosperous Jewish people in the country.
I don't know, Matt. That might be a stretch.
Right, yeah.
Because, one industry where they haven't penetrated is, of course, entertainment.
No, obviously. It's nowhere.
Or the media. I mean, it's the other sad thing.
Yes. Nowhere. I mean, the producer of the show is Jewish. The whole thing's preposterous. Also, I should warn viewers that if your young school-aged daughter or son, for that matter, is watching this show, you should probably forbid them. it's bad. Bad values. So I don't know. Should we talk about real estate? Circle back.
Oh, sure. Let's circle back on the zoning real estate thing.
Well, and also rich people, though. Because
yes.
A lot of people, if you bought a house at the right time, it looked like you were going to be really, really cashing in, at least for a while now. But things seem to be on the slide.
Yeah, it's I'm toying with the idea of buying a house at a foreclosure auction, and I know that this is an incredibly bad idea, it's a deal, and I can't resist the idea of a deal, especially because if you're a journalist, that's about the only way you're ever going to get a decent house.
Sure.
I mentioned that I was thinking about doing this, and God, all of a sudden everyone I know is besieging me with, is it the right time to buy? Is it the right time to buy? Is the market bottomed out? Which
is what happens if you write about business, right?
Yes, exactly.
You become an oracle. Who knows?
I am the oracle of the housing market.
Players. And that's actually why you're working as a journalist instead of trading. And
yes.
Making money. It would be too easy.
Exactly. I mean, I'm done with that. I'm done with the money-making part of my life.
Sure,
now I'm into
sure.
public service.
We're on to ideas.
Well, I actually am kind of proud, though. I talked a number of friends out of buying houses at the top of the market. And I was like, I got out my little charts, I did interest rates, and I talked to a number of other friends out of financing with ridiculous adjustable rate arms, with like 2-year resets and various things. They're now possibly mad at me because they don't have homes.
Sure.
But on the other hand, they also don't have a big mortgage hanging around their neck with falling home equity.
Right.
The market is clearly out, and this is actually in D.C. and New York, it hasn't fallen. Prices are kind of steady, and supply is falling. So a lot of people bought stuff to flip,
right.
And they're holding it off the market. In other areas, though, it's already like in Detroit, it now takes more than a year to sell your home on average. So the market's definitely out in other parts of country. Other parts of the country, and it's actually an interesting question for I've recently been working on a piece on the baby boomers,
uh-huh.
and what's going to happen when they retire. And one of the things that you realize is that a lot of people, there's this argument: do they have enough savings? And partly it's a question you can't answer, right? Like, is Social Security going to change?
Right, sure.
What's going to happen to corporate pensions? But one of the big things is that people are saying, well, they have enough savings because look at what's happened to the value of their houses.
Right.
And there's a couple of problems with this. The first is that baby boomers actually don't move that much.
Right.
Or like, for baby boomers, we don't know what they'll do. But in general, the elderly do not move. They move less than young people do.
Well, certainly they can't all simultaneously retire their houses and move to Arizona.
This is one of the huge problems with asset markets in general. Uh-huh. But the housing market is particularly problematic because you've had, over the past, most people our age, like, I watched Susie Orman maybe 6 months ago actually saying, like, don't put money in your 401k. I mean, put enough money to get the match and then plow the rest into housing. Because housing's safe, housing. And this is retarded financial advice. This is terrible, terrible advice. Do not listen to this. Because Susie Orman is being misled by the same thing that a number of people... like pretty much everyone in the country, for the last 50 years, house prices have risen faster than inflation, on right. average. You know, like the local disconnects and there's
inflation. Sure.
But there's been a number of reasons that that's true. Uh-huh. And people don't understand there's like these historical trends that have made that possible. So the first thing was actually just the invention of the long-term amortizing mortgage, which actually right. Was kind of invented in the 30s, but didn't become popular in the 50s. And then people started extending. So it was invented actually by FDR under the New Deal. It didn't take off. It got struck down in 1937. And then, but in the 40s, if you got a mortgage, to buy a house, you would have gotten probably a 5-year mortgage with a balloon
right.
payment
right.
for the entire value of the house.
But in the 50s, they started really encouraging people to use these.
Well, yeah, it's less they started encouraging them. They got better at credit rating people, uh-huh. and the banks got more stable because of the, anyway, so the banks got more stable. They started doing these long-term amortizing mortgages. And the result is people now, unlike before, they don't look at the price of the house. They look at the size of the payment that they can
right.
make. So that's the first development. And then you have inflation, which erodes the value of these mortgages and makes people want to take more of them. And then you have a fall in real interest rates, because once the Federal Reserve gets inflation under control, real interest rates start falling steadily, which means that mortgages get cheaper, which means people can make a bigger payment.
Right.
You also have changes in the tax code, which make mortgage in 1986, which make mortgage debt it's deductible for consumers, but no other kind of debt is.
Right.
So housing debt is now preferred over other kinds of debt. So you've got all these developments, all of which conspire to push up the price of existing houses.
Right.
And now eventually supply will usually come up to match it. But in some areas, like in Manhattan and in D.C., as we've been talking about, zoning constrains that supply. So you've got these long-term trends that are pushing up the demand for housing and so the price people are willing to pay for housing against a short-term fixed supply, and in some cases, long-term fixed supply, and that's raising the price of houses. But that's done. Mortgage terms can't get any easier. Interest rates can't go any lower. We're pretty much as far as we can go, and that means that house prices are almost certainly going to flatten out for a fairly long period of time. They may not fall, but you know, people who are counting on 5% house price increases, you know, every year. It uh-huh. may happen in some really hot markets like Manhattan, like D.C., where there is new money, where incomes are actually growing incredibly rapidly.
Sure.
But in the country as a whole, house prices are not going to increase any faster than incomes for probably quite a long time, which means, first of all, you should not plow your entire net worth into a house. And second of all, that when boomers go to sell, right, they're going to be selling into a market that's already kind of soft, and they're going to uh-huh. be trying to get equity out of houses. And that is going to have huge implications for how they're able to retire and where they're able to retire, and who and which of us is going to have mom living with us.
Ah. Okay.
You have an extra bedroom, right, Matt?
No, we don't. It's very unfortunate. So basically, people are doomed.
I wouldn't say doomed.
No, not doomed. No, because I think it's good, because we can talk amongst ourselves here. Because most people, I guess, own homes, you know, coverage of these things is always sort of in favor of housing prices getting more expensive. But for you or I, at least, you know, I've been, not just in a personal selfish sense, looking forward to a real estate apocalypse for a couple years now. You know, because I'm renting, but I would like to buy something sometime. So, you know, I say crash as soon as possible.
Well, the bad news, well, the good or the bad news, I guess, is
right.
if it crashes, probably we end up with the baby boomers working a lot longer.
Sure.
And in journalism, clogging up the vital jobs pipeline.
But they can't master the tricks of the blogging trade.
That's true.
The way we have. Because they're basically, they're obsolete.
But I feel like my plan to take over for Jim Lehrer maybe.
Maybe. he'll be working until he's 107.
Absolutely, because his house is not going to go up as much as he's probably been counting on.
With that disturbing thought, maybe we should close out.
Okay.
All right.
Well, goodbye, Internet.
I'll see you in the hallway.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, bye.